uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org, where you can also find the program being podcast. Welcome back to our program. It's Friday. Today, normally the day we have Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. However, Bernie is a little tied up at the moment, metaphorically speaking, of course, and not going to be able to be with us on the program today. He'll be back next week. He sends his greetings, best wishes, and apologies. So Congressman Sanders with us again next week. David Miller is with us, however. David is professor of sociology at the University of Strathclyde. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Professor Miller?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, 35 miles from Glen Eagles, where the G8 is meeting, or was meeting, just wrapped up. And I wanted to talk with you, if it's all right with you, about two things. The first being just, you know, your take on what's going on with the bombings in London. And then the second being what the G8 was really all about. I think that has been completely eclipsed, the whole discussion of, you know, why were these guys meeting? So let's look at the, if that's all right with you, let's look at the bombing first.
Sure.
Very interesting. Here in the United States, a front page story on the New York Times talks about how the bombing may be, for Tony Blair, a Spain moment. In other words, there was that moment in Spain where, after the Spanish bombing, where the leader of the Spanish people, I forget the fellow's name now, the fellow who is the president of Spain, came out and said, the prime minister, who came out and said, you know, oh, this is ETA or whatever, you know, please rally around me. And basically the Spanish people said,
no.
Yeah, right. They said, this is because you're in Iraq and there's no reason to be in Iraq, and so you're toast. And, you know, is that going to happen? The New York Times suggesting that may be happening. On the other hand, Knight Ridder newspapers here in the United States, which is syndicated all across the country, the only article that showed up in our local paper here in Oregon, was about how Blair and Bush will both gain tremendously politically from this bombing, because they'll be able to spin it as they're the tough guys fighting the terrorists, and see, these guys are, this proves that they're getting results because the terrorists are freaking out and fighting back. How is this going to play out in the UK, in your opinion?
Well, it's going to be one of those two, I think. I mean, that's going to be the interesting thing to watch. I think it's not going to be the same as 9/11, when a lot of people in the US and across the world felt that as a result of the attacks in New York, that everyone would have to be less critical of the US for a while. And that, in the end, I think, resulted in the US being, and actually the UK government, being able to pass a whole series of draconian legislation and help them to go into Afghanistan and Iraq. But I think that the experience of Iraq, and this is what happened in Spain, the experience of Iraq has turned people off so much, because they have seen through some of the lies they've been told about. I remember in the US, the notion that the 9/11 hijackers were linked to Iraq, which of course was false. And in the UK, we were told that Saddam Hussein had chemical and biological weapons he could launch at 45 minutes notice, which was not just false, but was known to be false by the government at the time. So that scepticism as a result of that means that the government will find it much more difficult to use this in its own immediate interests. Now, of course, it's not to say that they won't try. They clearly will try. And one of the first things that they've tried to do, which we noticed today, is that they're saying that the reason that nothing has come out of the G8 summit is because Tony Blair wasn't there to knock heads together, because he had to go and deal with the terrorism incident. Well, I mean, it's quite clear that nothing significant was going to come out of the G8 summit which was going to help anyone in Africa or anyone around the world in relation to climate change.
Now, which brings us to the G8. Give us an overview. I suspect probably most of our listeners only have a vague understanding of what the G8 is to begin with. Who are the G8 nations? Why are they getting together? Why do they do this every year?
Well, they've been doing it for 30 years. They were originally the G6, and they were the ones who came up with the promises that they would give 0.3% of GDP in aid to developing countries in 1975, which is, what, 30 years ago now?
Mm-hmm.
And they've slowly added members, eventually Russia joining just recently, to make the G8. Now, these are not the eight largest economies in the world, because if it was, then they would have to include China and India. But the most powerful countries in the world who get together every year to meet. Now, if you're a Democrat, I don't mean a member of the party, but if you believe in democracy, then presumably world government should be run by all the countries of the world through the democratically elected representatives. But actually, what happens is that the G8 meet every year in concert with the leading international financial institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, to decide how to respond and to how to carve up the world's resources, essentially. So what they're doing here, contrary to what people think sometimes, people think, oh, it's just a big junket, they have big sumptuous meals, they have the best wine, they go out and play golf. The Gleneagles Hotel, where the event is happening, is a world-famous golf course, as many of your listeners will know.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there is that element to it. There is the junketing, there is the high-powered networking and all that kind of thing. But it is also an opportunity for the eight leaders of the most powerful nations on earth, the US, the UK, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan and Russia, to get together to decide how most effectively to steal the world's natural resources and to continue in power so that other countries can't get democratic decision-making power. So that's the kind of general picture with the G8.
I think you're suggesting that the meeting of the G8 is what the conspiracy theorists have been saying is what the Bilderbergers are all about or whatever. I mean, there's all these conspiracies about who really runs the world.
Sure.
And you're suggesting it's not a conspiracy. It's right out in the open. They just had a meeting, and it's called the G8.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, it's not a conspiracy in the conspiracy theorist sense of secret dark rooms and that kind of thing, but it is a conspiracy of interest. And the Bilderberg thing isn't the conspiracy which runs the world, but it is part of the open conspiracies where people get together and they run things. The other conspiracies are called the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. But it's not a conspiracy in the sense of individuals running the world. It's a conspiracy in the sense of them acting in the interests of the rich and the powerful corporations. And that's the key thing to it here. That's why they won't let the other countries in, because they're keen on preserving their own interests. And you can see that in relation to Africa. I mean, I think, in a way, George Bush is admirably straight about this, in a way that Blair and Brown, who's the Chancellor of the Exchequer here, are not. I mean, Bush says just the other day on television, I go into the G8 summit to bat for U.S. interests. I'm not interested in anything else. It's U.S. interests that come first, and that's it. And that seems fairly straightforward. Whereas with Blair, what he says is that I go into the G8 summit to try and help the people of Africa, to abolish poverty, to challenge climate change. But whereas actually what's happening here is that they are putting together some measures to alleviate some debt in Africa. But the hidden message here is that there are strings attached to it. There are some countries are allowed to get some debt relief, a very small amount of debt relief, but they're only allowed to do it if they open up their economies to Western corporations, if they privatize their health, education, and water systems, and they allow access to the natural resources, the huge wealth of natural resources in Africa for Western companies.
So you're suggesting this is not just a nationalist agenda, this is a corporatist agenda.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the spearhead of this, I think, globally at the moment is the UK government as opposed to the Bush administration. And the UK government are slightly cleverer with their spin, because they have this rhetoric of helping Africa, whereas in reality, you read down any of their speeches, a couple of paragraphs, you look at the footnotes in the press releases, and they're quite plain about this. When they issue their statements, they're quite plain that the purpose of this is to encourage foreign investment and foreign multinationals to go into Africa and to open up those economies. And they actually require, for example, Tanzania had to privatize its education system, so children have to pay to go to school there now. That was required by the IMF and by the G8.
Wait a second. We went into Tanzania and said, if you want to get aid or if you want to get debt relief, you have to turn your public school system over to corporations?
Sure. And that's what's happening all over the place. In Ghana, there's been a big battle over water privatization. Some of your listeners will know about the situation in Bolivia, where in Cochabamba, the people rose up against that.
Oh, I wrote a chapter about it in a book I wrote called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
And so all over Africa, the same thing is happening. And this is being led by the Brown and the Blair administration. People in this country, in Britain, don't really know this about Brown. They think of him as being a kind of center-left a leader who's seriously concerned about poverty, but he also chairs the key and most important committee of the International Monetary Fund, which is imposing this this agenda, the IMF Washington Consensus agenda for African countries to open up to Western cooperation.
In a very real way, this is taking us back then to the days when the British East India Company ruled the ruling force, and everything was done for their benefit, and they basically had bought out the Parliament, and the King was the major shareholder, and the Queen, actually Queen Elizabeth I, was the one who chartered it in December of 1601, I believe it was.
Sure. It is. I mean, I think it's like colonialism, like the British Empire, except without the mass military occupation. Though, of course, as you I'm sure the first to point out, there is, of course, military occupation involved in Iraq at the moment.
Certainly.
And that is the military wing of global capital, if you like, and that's what they do if it's necessary, but it's not necessary most of the time because they have the corporations to do it. So rather than military occupation, they have occupation by foreign transnationals. I mean, you look at the example of Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's been a terrible civil war, which is over the resources of the fabulously rich country this is, including the rare metal coltan, which is the main, and the DRC is the main source of coltan, and as your listeners will know, that is the metal which is required to make mobile or cell telephones. So, our life in Britain or in the US depends on the corporations being able to get in there and exploit things, and that leads then to the whole question of corruption. I mean, George Bush said the other day that aid would only be increased if there was good governance in Africa, and that sounds pretty good to most people. They think, yes, there shouldn't be corruption. These African dictators and the
by good governance, they mean our kleptocracies, not somebody else's kleptocracies.
That's exactly what they mean. They mean selling off.
What's the alternative, David Miller? I'm sorry, we only have about a half a minute here left,
sure.
and certainly the alternative deserves more than that. But what's the alternative? What should we do?
Okay, well, I mean, the first thing to do is, of course, that the G8 would need to be abolished. But I mean, the key thing which needs to be done in Africa, as needs to be done in the US and the UK, is to restore democracy, to restore the meaningful content of democracy.
Genuine liberal democracy.
Genuine democracy, yes. And I think we have the same problems in the UK and the US as they have in Africa. We, just very briefly, we had a large alternative summit on Sunday in Edinburgh, the biggest political meeting ever seen in Edinburgh's history, 5,000 people, 60-odd meetings, activists and writers and others from across the world, from all five continents, from Africa, from Latin America. And it's quite clear that it's not just that people have different problems and we should help each other out, but that we all have the same problems. We're all facing a neoliberal model which imposes privatization of health or water or education or whatever's left of the public sector, and increases poverty and inequality and causes wars. And so we all felt from that meeting that we all have to join together globally to make democracy real again.
And this is what needs to be changed. David Miller, Professor of Sociology at the University of Strathclyde near Glasgow, Scotland. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Miller.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, tomhartman.com. Click live chat if you want to drop into our live chat room. Have we lost the war in Iraq? Did we officially lose it yesterday? You think I'm talking about the bombing in the UK and England? No. Former foes, Iran and Iraq, this from Reuters, said yesterday, now, in fact, before I read this, let me just give you a little bit of background on this. Iran and Iraq were at war for a decade. During that time, over a million people died in that war. We were overtly supporting Saddam Hussein in that war. We were providing him with weapons. We were providing him with poison gas. We were providing him with bombs. We were providing intelligence to the Iranians about Saddam's troop movements, because we didn't want Iran to take over Iraq. Because Iran's agenda for Iraq, because the majority of Iraq is Shia, and Iran is entirely Shia, or virtually entirely Shia. And the Shia in the Middle East, by and large, are a minority. There are a bunch of Shia in Lebanon. There are a fair number of Shia in Syria, and that's about it. And most of the rest of the Middle East is Sunni. Osama bin Laden is a Sunni. The Saudis are Sunnis. The Wahhabists are all Sunnis. And the Shia and the Sunnis get along about as well as the Protestants and the Catholics did back in the 9th century, or the 14th, 13th, 14th century. Not so well, let's say. So, or with, you know, a wariness, an unease. And so we did not want Iran to take over Iraq because that would establish this massive theocratic Shia foothold in the Middle East. And we concluded, several presidents, over a series of administrations, concluded that that would not be in the best interest of the United States. And, of course, what Iran really wanted, was to cut a deal with Iraq. They wanted to have a strategic partnership with Iraq. They wanted to take Iraq under the... What they really wanted was to get Saddam Hussein out of the way, assassinate Saddam Hussein. Iran was sponsoring the terrorist groups within Iraq that were working to kill Saddam Hussein. They were the prime sponsors of the anti-Saddam groups inside Iraq, where Saddam was always killing his enemies. It was always the Shia, and they were getting their money from Iran. Iran was sponsoring the attempts to destabilize Iraq. And so Iran wanted Saddam Hussein out of Iraq, and they wanted there to be elections in Iraq, because they knew if there were elections, they'd win, because the majority of Iraq is Shia. And so George Bush came along and said, okay, I'll give you what you want. Now get this, is this in the interest of the United States? For us to do Iran's bidding? Well, how would we do that? Well, it turns out that an Iranian spy by the name of Ahmed Chalabi was planted in the Defense Department, and he fed phony information to Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and George Bush, and they bought it. Oh, there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and the people will welcome you as liberators. They bought it, and we did Iran's bidding. We took out Saddam Hussein, and then we tried initially to say, well, there won't be elections, and the Shia stood up and said, no, there's going to be elections, Sistani and Sadr. And so we had to bend to that pressure, and we had elections, and sure enough, the Shia are winning. And now, Iran and Iraq yesterday said they are signing a military cooperation agreement that includes Iranian help in training Iraq's military forces, despite likely U.S. opposition. Now, this is incredible. This is after an 8-year war from 1980 to 1988. Iranian defense minister says, this is a new chapter in our relations with Iraq. Yes, it is. He says, we will start wide defense cooperation. Does that mean we attack Iran and Iraq has to go to their defense? He says, we're going to form some committees which will be involved in mine clearance, identifying those missing from the war, and also to help train, rebuild, and modernize the Iraqi army. Iran has offered $1 billion in aid to Iraq. Iran giving Iraq $1 billion to help them rebuild their country after the destruction of their country by the American invasion. Asked about possible opposition, Shamkhani said, quote, no one can prevent us from reaching an agreement. Next week, the Prime Minister of Iraq, Jafari, is going to Tehran. George Bush has shot himself in the foot. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Our phone number, tomhartman.com. The website, GOP Senate candidate demands lower wages in America. Yes, the National Republican Party has recruited Domino Pizza CEO David Brandon, or they're in the process of recruiting him, as their candidate for Michigan. For Michigan. The Wall Street Journal reported, this from David Sirota, the Wall Street Journal reported that after the 2004 election, Brandon was the guy who said he is, quote, counting on the president to counter any potential moves to increase the minimum wage, end quote. Even though the minimum wage is nearing a 50-year low in terms of purchasing power. Brandon, a longtime Republican donor, has many weapons at his disposal to make sure wages in the state of Michigan stay low. Since 1998, Domino's has given the Republican Party more than $100,000. There's plenty of support among the Republican Party, notes David Sirota, in Michigan, to keep wages in their state low. Consider the chairwoman of the Michigan GOP, Betsy DeVos, of the billionaire family that controls Amway. In 2004, she actually issued a press release claiming that, quote, most of the economic problems in Michigan are a result of high wages, end quote. Yeah, that's the problem. We're paying our workers too much. Not our CEOs. No, no, don't go near that. It's those nasty workers. How dare they want to have enough money to buy the stuff we're making? Oh, we're not making it anymore? The stuff that we're importing. The stuff that we're having made in China. How dare they want to have enough of a paycheck to do that? Michigan ranks dead last among the states and the District of Columbia in personal income growth since 2000. Why? Well, it could have something to do with the chairwoman of the Michigan GOP saying that Michigan should be, that the problems in Michigan, the economic problems in Michigan, are the result of high wages. So in that case, David Brandon's the perfect guy. You know, the CEO of Domino's Pizza, I mean, the guy knows, he understands cheap wages. I should reveal, I suppose, at this moment, what is this called? I forget what it's called. Anyhow, where you reveal some bit of your background. I once worked at a Domino's in Michigan when I was 16 years old. Now, back then, if you were 16 years old, it was a decent job. And, you know, it was mostly high school kids. I mean, that's my recollection of working at Domino's, was that it was a low-wage job. I only worked there for a few months until I could find something better, which happened to be the gas station across the street on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing, Michigan. But I worked at Domino's. And so I guess Domino's has changed. Everything has changed. The whole idea of middle-class wage earners has changed in the United States. And the idea that low-paying jobs are the place where, you know, high school kids go or college kids go to work their way through college, and then when you get out of school, you can get a better job, you get a job in a factory, you get a good white-collar job, as, you know, whatever it may be. And with that job, if you play by the rules of the game, and you put in your time and you show up for work, that you can put your family through, you can put your kids through school, you can support your family, you can buy a home and a car and have money set aside for retirement or have a good pension. You know, that was the American dream. And it was real until Ronald Reagan came along and began to systematically dismantle it with his assault, his absolute frontal assault, which continues to this day, on liberal democracy, on representative democracy in the United States. As David Sirota says, apparently for the GOP and its top-tier Senate candidates, wages in Michigan need to be even lower than they are now so that their corporate donors can buy extra yachts. And what's interesting is that there is now less and less of a distinction between GOP candidates and GOP donors. They're becoming one and the same. This year alone, two of their top-tier potential candidates are Brandon and multimillionaire Bentley-driving corporate executive Rich Tarrant in Vermont. With senators like that, you can bet the GOP, David says, will get its way and fully eliminate the minimum wage for millions of workers. And, you know, keep in mind, it was the GOP, it was the Republican Party that has been working, that has been fighting the minimum wage since its inception. When the minimum wage was first put forward back in the 19-teens, it was the Republicans who said, no, this is wrong, this shouldn't happen. But it passed, and it took the Supreme Court to say that it was illegal. It was unconstitutional. And then in 1937, got, you know, made it through, made it past the Supreme Court. I'm sure the Supreme Court had a change of mind. And what does Janice Rogers Brown have to say about that? The woman who, if we have two or three Supreme Court openings over the next few months, and odds are we will, looks like Rehnquist and John Paul Stevens are both getting ready to retire. Janice Rogers Brown is one of the leading contenders for one of those spots. What does she have to say about this? Well, she says that 1937 was the height of our socialist revolution in the United States. How dare those nasty socialists want socialist things like minimum wage laws, worker protection laws, the right to unionize. It's just wrong. Can't have that. Similarly, the conservatives are saying, how dare people want to have protection from predatory power companies? This from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Dan Richmond wrote this. Five words poised to slip quietly into a new federal energy law could reduce the protection consumers now enjoy against high power costs like those extracted from West Coast residents in 2000-2001. This is just absolutely incredible. The default standard that is used by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, this is the federal body representing you and me that makes sure that we don't get terribly ripped off by power companies. At this moment, has to make decisions based on the public interest. Now, that makes sense, given that they're a federal agency. If they're a federal agency, they're supposed to be about the public interest. That's what it's all about. I mean, that's the whole point, right? Well, the cons want to change. This was actually first apparently slipped in by Billy Townsend, a Republican, who strongly supported the oil industry back when he was the head of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, although we're not absolutely certain. Nobody's sure who slipped this language into this bill. But this language will replace the phrase contrary to the public interest with the phrase just and reasonable as the default standard by which a key federal agency decides whether it can alter power prices agreed to between a buyer and a seller. So whether it's in the public interest or not is no longer part of the equation. Is it just and reasonable? Representative Jay Inslee, Democrat of Washington, says this language change was sprung in the dead of the night. He said there were no hearings. Someone was very deviously bright when they drafted this language. We lost $1 billion out of the economy because of power market manipulations, says Inslee. $1 billion. He says, talk about chutzpah. This administration is reducing protection to consumers in the wake of this? I have to agree, it's really quite remarkable. FERC sometimes lets buyers of electricity change their contracts if those agreements contain prices that aren't just and reasonable. The House bill, which would amend the 70-year-old Federal Power Act, agreements would have to be contrary to public interest to be changeable by either buyers and sellers unless the agreements specify the just and reasonable standard. It's really rather remarkable. Now, that said, I think, you know, it's interesting that we should reconsider also what happened in Iraq over the last 2 days. I mean, yesterday, one of the bloodiest days in Iraq. There was one car bombing. This may have been parallel to the bombings in London with the bus. The bus, of course, went off nearly an hour after the first bomb went off in the subway. It was some 40 minutes, as I recall, more or less. And in Iraq, there was a car bombing. And this is an increasingly common, by the way, strategy of these folks in Iraq. There was a car bombing. People show up to help the people who are injured around the car bombing. And then a second bomb goes off to kill the rescuers. And some are suggesting that the reason why the bus bomb was so much later than the train bombs was because after the train bombs happened, everybody would flee out of the train stations and they would get on buses. And then you blow up the bus. Now, George W. Bush says that the reason why we are in Iraq, keep in mind, Al-Qaeda, an Al-Qaeda group that has claimed credit for this. We can't verify that they're actually responsible for it, but they've claimed credit for it. They said that they did it because we were in Iraq. and Afghanistan. And Bush says that the reason we're in Iraq is because, quote, we are fighting these terrorists with our military in Afghanistan and Iraq and beyond so that we do not have to face them in the streets of our own cities, end quote. Yesterday I heard another right-wing talk show host, another talk show host of the right-wing variety, let's say, I heard him say, you know, we don't need to beef up security around our ports in the United States. We don't need to be testing and checking the cargo on our airplanes. We don't need to be monitoring our chemical plants. We don't need to protect our nuclear facilities. All we need to do is go over to the Middle East and kill all these terrorists. I was, you know, just stunned by the stupidity of such a statement. The absolute and utter stupidity. It assumes, first of all, that these people are incapable of doing two things at once. The Brits learned yesterday that they're not incapable of doing two things at once. First of all. Secondly, it assumes that it's people from Iraq who did this. And I, you know, all the evidence is that it's not. We're still dealing with Saudis here. Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, he's from Saudi Arabia. And, oh, you know, did George Bush catch him dead or alive? No, he bombed England yesterday. Is Bush going to be held to account for that? For his failure to get Osama? We'll see. But are, you know, are we really supposed to believe that these guys, you know, that they can't walk and chew gum? I don't think so. And not only that, the other implication of this is that our troops are flypaper. I don't think that anybody signed up for the military saying, I'd like to volunteer to go over and be a sacrificial lamb. I'd like to be the lamb that gets staked out there so that the lions can come eat it. I just can't imagine it. But that's what George Bush is trying to tell us. Can you imagine how the military families must feel? This is just so wrong. The White House, as David Sirota notes, the White House has knowingly left our ports, our borders, and yes, our transit systems totally vulnerable to terrorist attacks because they refuse to spend adequate resources, even as they have insisted on cutting taxes for the wealthy and plunging us into a war in Iraq. And every time they have tried to cut those taxes, cut those taxes and cut funding for things like security for our rail system, the Republicans, every time Democrats have tried to stop that, Republicans have stopped them. Just a few weeks ago, Democrats put forward a program to increase funding for transit security. Republicans, no, you can't do that. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Rick in Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Is this Rick you're talking with?
You're the Rick.
Okay, there are two of us from Grand Rapids. That's what your screener told me, Tom.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm not the one that calls as often, but that's okay. I'm glad he also calls, too. I had two questions for you, Tom. Number one, do you think this situation with this Carol Rove thing with the outage of that Mrs. Wilson, is that a possibility that this could blow up into Carol Rove being forced out and perhaps even impeachment against Bush? No, that's my first question.
I'd put the probability at about 5% or less right now, and if the Democrats take either the House or Senate in 2006 at 80 or 90%.
Cool. Okay, the other question I had, this is totally hypothetical. Have you ever participated or been asked to participate in a debate against someone like a Rush Limbaugh? And I'd love to see that.
Sure, yeah. C-SPAN televised it, in fact. I was in a debate with Laura Ingraham and several other conservatives in a panel
right,
at the Heritage Foundation, you know, a year ago. In fact, we try to get them to come on this program. I used to debate conservatives in this program all the time. Before the election, they were willing to come on. Now they just want to talk to themselves, so unfortunately.
Sure. Well, you took them to the cleaners, by the way. I remember watching that. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Tom. Thank you. Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it. Jerry in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Tom, you know, I think you're being disingenuous, honestly. Okay, to start off the conversation, let me tell you that I'm a libertarian, okay?
All right.
I hate the Republicans, and I hate the Democrats. I hate them all.
Okay.
Okay? Because they have equally shared in destroying what was once a very prosperous country.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you to some extent. I would say that there are some honest and ethical Republicans and there are some honest and ethical Democrats. And frankly, I think that there are more left in the Democratic Party. I think the Republican Party has done a very good job of purging its ranks of those people who might have some ethics left.
Well, I disagree, but again, I think that there's maybe two guys in the Congress who are honest.
Okay, but what's your point, Jerry? Give me a word.
Okay.
We just have a few seconds.
My point
left.
Is, I actually wanted to dispel the notion of tax cuts for the rich. I'm not a rich guy. I made $62,000 last year.
Yeah, then you got nothing compared to what the Walton family got. I'm telling you.
I don't care about nothing as a percentage. You're a jerk, Walton.
Oh, I am.
You know?
Okay, that's great. So George Bush goes out and he says, okay, anybody who earns their living sitting around the pool on their butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, they only pay 15% income tax. You, Jerry, you're going to have to pay up to 35%, and you think that's just fine. I got it. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's never too late to start all over again.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, and Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yeah, this is the other Rick.
There you go.
Boy, that libertarian was a piece of work.
Well,
very insulting to you.
Yeah, you know, that happens. I mean, you know, what can you say? Not everybody has the ability to argue issues on the merit of the issues. And so, you know, when that happens, you just consider the source.
But we won't waste any more time. And I wanted to, this is a little bit off the wall, but I just wanted to kind of talk to you about this. You know, you and I have talked in the past about how on the right, one of the few maybe honest organizations would be the John Birch Society. Well, I just got onto their website this week, and they got something called a Trim Bulletin, which ranks Congress people, you know, senators and representatives on their integrity. The
yeah, let me say, by the way, that I would not take the position that on the right, one of the few organizations with integrity is the John Birch Society.
Well,
I've had no connection with them in over 30 years, and I only went to one meeting once when I was 13 years old. So that's, you know, I'm not an expert in any way about the John Birch Society.
Just let me
I read and I read a bunch of their literature when I was a teenager. That's it. So you know, where they're at today, I have no idea.
Okay, let me say it about myself only then.
Okay.
And what they've done is they've got this Trim Bulletin, and believe it or not, and I just wanted to see what you make of this. They actually rank Bernie Sanders, you know, the man who appears on your show on Fridays, with having more integrity to the Constitution and fiscal responsibility than our own Vern Ehlers. And they only rate Tom DeLay as 1 point ahead of Bernie Sanders. Now, this means one of two things. It either means that conservative Republicans aren't what they appear to be, or else the Birchers are really delusional. What do you think?
Or Bernie's not what he appears to be. One of those three. Well, let me tell you. First of all, Bernie is what he appears to be.
Oh, sure he is.
Secondly, their criteria is you know, well, I just don't know, Rick, because I don't have the criteria in front of me, and I'd hate to guess on it and just, you know, be completely off.
Well, Bernie
it's fascinating. You know, I think it's fascinating. But
Bernie did vote against the debt limit increase. They really respected him for that.
Yeah, yeah. And Bernie is a guy who is absolutely in favor of fiscal sanity. And historically, that was a conservative position. That's not the position of the Republican Party today, but that's because the Republican Party isn't conservative anymore. It's radical. You know, radicals are in favor of rapid change. Conservatives are in favor of slow change. That's the spectrum. It's not a conservative-liberal spectrum. Liberals are in favor of representative democracy. That's a whole different thing. You've got liberals versus fascists on one spectrum. You got conservatives versus radicals on another spectrum. And so, you know, these guys, these Republicans, they are not conservatives. They're radicals. They're in favor of rapid change in a fascistic direction, corporate dominance of the commons. And not a healthy thing for us, I'll tell you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio, and thanks for the call, Rick. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Call calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends, to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Andy Stevenson. Andy Stevenson is one of the folks who started out working with Bev Harris with blackboxvoting.org. He was a crusader for voting rights in America. Andy Stevenson developed pancreatic cancer. He didn't have insurance. I wrote an op-ed suggesting that people, if they wanted to stand up for Andy, stand up for democracy, that they should send a donation to a fund that had been put together to help pay for his operation for his pancreatic cancer. He had to raise $50,000 before the hospital would accept him for surgery. And we raised the $50,000, and me and others, so there was a number of other people involved in this, we raised that money. Andy had his surgery. Apparently it was not successful. Last night at 9:27 Pacific time, Andy Stevenson passed on. So I want to acknowledge Andy, and Andy, wherever you are, thank you for the great life you led and the good work you did. And, you know, may you be an inspiration to many. Ed Gillespie. Good old Ed Gillespie. If the allegation is true to this is the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. If the allegation is true to reveal the identity of an undercover CIA operative, it's abhorrent. And it should be a crime. And it is a crime. That on Hardball, 2 years ago, about that same time, Joe Wilson just being rather outspoken about all this.
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marks out of the White House in handcuffs.
That 2 years ago. 2 years ago. And Joe Wilson, the diplomat always.
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
I measure my words. Karl Rove. Joe Wilson outing him a couple of years ago. Apparently, George Bush couldn't bother to go over and knock on Karl's door and say, hey, Karl, are you the guy who committed treason here in the White House? Are you the traitor who outed Valerie Plame, who outed the CIA agent, who brought down an entire CIA counterterrorism operation in the CIA? Are you the guy? He couldn't be bothered to go over and knock on Karl's door, even though he had Joe Wilson, the husband of the victim, publicly saying this, because old George, this is what he had to say.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
I just don't have any idea. Yeah, well, a few other folks have an idea, George. And Karen Hughes, back in October 2nd of 2003, President Bush has said, and I agree, there are too many leaks in Washington. We didn't experience that kind of situation when we were here in Texas. No, they just took leakers out and shot them, right? Yeah, old Alberto would just sign the death warrants. Anyhow, she says, I think it's very disruptive to democracy. Whoever did this leak, obviously it was not serving President Bush very well. John Ashcroft, anyone who purposely leaks information that has been classified is, for some reason, it's incomprehensible to me. He says, but for some reason, subordinating a national security, if they purposefully leak information, that's interesting. John Ashcroft throws into his October 16th, 03 statement the very caveat that Karl Rove's lawyer put out last Friday. If they purposefully leak information, supporting the national security of the United States to some interests of their own. That's interesting. What do you want to bet John Ashcroft knew all along that it was Karl Rove? George Herbert Walker Bush, 426.99. I have nothing but contempt and anger for those who betray the trust by exposing the name of our sources. They are, in my view, the most insidious of traitors. Traitors. You have a traitor, George W., in your staff, but you don't have any idea, do you? Colin Powell. Not only do you put her at risk, or any undercover agent at risk, by letting it be known that they're an agent, but you also put the sources they've worked with over the years at considerable risk. Yeah, well said. Plamegate, the American Progress, the Center for American Progress, did a great summary of this thing. They, it, you know, we do the research so mainstream media reporters don't have to. I mean, this is, it's absolutely incredible. The White House Press Corps, Scotty McClellan, you know, several days after it was revealed by Lawrence O'Donnell that it was Karl Rove, who Matt Cooper was willing to go to jail to protect. It was Karl Rove. Nobody in the White House press corps asked Scotty McClellan, what about Karl Rove? Is he going to be fired? It's not being discussed in the mainstream media. Other than Keith Olbermann's program, Countdown, on MSNBC, I haven't seen it anywhere. Now, that's not to say it's not out there. I certainly am not, you know, all-seeing, but there's just this deafening silence. Well, the mainstream media may say, this isn't important at all. Well, as Lawrence O'Donnell pointed out, all the judges, this is a quote from Lawrence, all the judges who have seen the prosecutor's secret evidence firmly believe he is pursuing a very serious crime, and they have done everything they can to help him get an indictment, end of quote. Likewise, notes the Center for American Progress, when asked whether exposing Valerie Plame's identity would be worse than Watergate, President Bush's close colleague Ed Gillespie said, yeah, I suppose in terms of the real-world implications of it, adding that to reveal the identity of an undercover CIA operative, it's abhorrent, it should be a crime. It is a crime. Yeah. Karl Rove has not yet told us whether he is the subject of an investigation. There are three levels of investigation associated with a grand jury. A grand jury can have an object of an investigation. That means that they are the target. Excuse me, not object, target. You can be the object or the target of a grand jury investigation, which means they're coming after you. You're the guy they're trying to get. You can be a witness in a grand jury investigation, which means that you are absolutely clean. You have some information they need, but you don't have to worry. Or you can be a subject of a grand jury investigation. Subject of a grand jury investigation means that they are checking you out seriously and they may be ready to nail you to the wall. Nobody has asked Karl Rove or his attorney whether he is the subject of an investigation, to the best of my knowledge. And as far as we can tell, he certainly avoided saying whether he is or he isn't. But there have been several visits, two or three times Karl Rove has shown up before the grand jury. And this is causing some people to think that he's more than just a witness. In fact, as one lawyer said, there is growing concern in the White House that the prosecutor is interested in Rove. Interesting. Rove has never denied that he leaked the identity of Joe Wilson's wife. The public statements by Karl Rove and his attorney Robert Luskin regarding Rove's role have been worded vaguely in such a way that leaves unclear whether Rove is denying that he ever revealed in any way the true identity of Joe Wilson's wife, or whether he is merely denying that he revealed the specific name, Valerie Plame, also her maiden name, that she used while carrying out her covert work. Rove's attorney told Newsweek that Rove, quote, did not tell any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA, end quote. He also told the Los Angeles Times that Rove, quote, absolutely did not identify Valerie Plame, end quote. Well, maybe he said Valerie Wilson. In 2004, August of 2004, Rove denied knowing Plame's name. He said, well, I'll repeat what I said to ABC News when this whole thing broke some number of months ago. I didn't know her name and didn't leak her name. End quote. In other words, I didn't have sex with that woman defense. These statements only confirm that Rove did not leak Plame's name, not whether he revealed her role as a covert operative. Yeah. He's almost uniformly stated that Rove never knowingly disclosed classified information. This is his lawyer. Although on one occasion, he said to Bloomberg News, Rove did not reveal any confidential information, leaving off the word knowingly. that might have been an error with regard to Bloomberg News, because he always usually inserts the word knowingly. As Lawrence O'Donnell pointed out, quote, not coincidentally, the word knowing is the most important word in the controlling statute. U.S. Code Title 50, Section 421. To violate the law, Rove had to tell Cooper about a covert agent, quote, knowing that the information disclosed so identifies such covert agent and that the United States is taking affirmative measures to conceal such covert agent's intelligence relationship to the United States, end quote. So did he unknowingly disclose classified information? Josh Marshall, a reporter for The Hill, an insider publication in Washington, D.C., interpreted the relevant laws to hold that, quote, a government insider with access to classified information, such as Rove, is also prohibited from confirming or further disseminating the identity of a covert agent even after someone else has leaked it. So did Rome, did, you know, Karl Rove, he could come clean anytime he wants, he could simply come out and say, hey, that's it, I didn't do this, I had nothing to do with this. Be unambiguous. Why is he so carefully parsing his words? For that matter, why is the Bush administration allowing Judy Miller to go to jail? Why are they making a martyr out of this woman who's been so close to them, so much on their side? At any time, George Bush could come forward and he could say, you know, we've done an investigation, we found out who it is, here's the guy, here's Karl Rove, haul him off. Or whoever it may be. John Dean, the former lawyer for Richard Nixon, on Tuesday said, quote, whoever it is, he or she is a huge coward. And the fact that they would let somebody go to prison, this is the sort of thing mafia people do, drug kingpins do, not somebody who's serving in the White House as a public servant. He said that, by the way, on Keith Olbermann's countdown program. Again, as far as I know, the only national television news program to be even discussing this topic. Karl Rove and Robert Novak, by the way, have a history. They have a relationship that goes back a long way, and that relationship isn't just a friendship. They have a long history of spreading damaging information. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, Ron Suskin reported in Esquire, according to the Center for American Progress, that sources close to the former president, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush Sr., say Rove was fired from the 1992 Bush presidential campaign after he planted a negative story with columnist Robert Novak about dissatisfaction with campaign fundraising chief and Bush loyalist Robert Mosbacher Jr. It was smoked out and he was summarily ousted. Yeah, so Karl Rove has done this kind of thing before, and he's done it with Robert Novak before. A little bit more of the smoking gun there, I would say. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, indeed, summer is here. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Victoria Jones is with us, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Reporting live from the belly of the beast. How you doing? What's up?
I'm doing very well. Well, Congress is getting ready to come back, and I can, just by looking at what hearings are planned for next week, I can tell that there are going to be some that will certainly start to focus more on bombing threats here and infrastructure. The Congressman, God, if you hadn't asked me his name, I could have told you, from New Jersey, Bill, I want to say passed. He's my former congressman. Okay, huge embarrassment. Major congressman from New Jersey, right, who, unknown, unnamed, who serves on both the House Homeland Security and Infrastructure and Transportation Committees, made the point to me in an interview that the money simply has not been spent on mass transport. He gave the, he said it's the equivalent of $11 per person on, this is just an equivalent, $11 per person on aviation versus a penny on trains and mass transport.
Yeah,
we've
spent $18.1 billion with our airlines since from 9/11 until today, and we spend $250 million in the next year's budget for trains and everything other than planes. Earl Blumenauer, the congressman from Oregon, told me on the air yesterday, we're spending the exact same amount on TSA as we are for the entire FBI budget. We're spending the same amount to frisk Granny at the airport as we are to track down terrorists inside the United States. And the fact is that 16 times more people travel on public transportation, 32 million times a day, 16 times more than travel on domestic airlines. Why is it then that domestic airlines get billions, teens in the billions, and everything else gets less than $1 billion, a quarter of a billion, $250 million? Well, it could be that the fat cats and the politicians don't travel on public transportation. They only fly on airplanes.
Well, I mean, that certainly could be a piece of it, probably a very big piece of it. Also, I think flying is more dramatic. People are more scared about the idea of, oh, I'm going to die in a plane crash, than they are thinking about what could happen in a train crash.
Well, and the other thing is there's a huge, the airline industry has billions of dollars, millions they spend on lobbyists, and Amtrak is forbidden from having lobbyists, I believe, because they're a part federal agency. And, you know, your mass transit systems, they don't have lobbyists.
Well, and who's going to lobby for Greyhound?
Right.
You know,
right,
and who's going to listen to the lobby for Greyhound? I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
It is very, very interesting to see how this is going to play out. I think we're going to see quite a bit of increased attention on mass transit. There also is yet another of the hearings on the viability of the airlines next week, and I've got to think that their lack of viability and inability to make themselves productive, shall we say, for want of a better word, or in any way successful, despite the billions that have been poured into them, is something that's going to come up.
Yeah, we had a healthy and vital airline industry before deregulation. You know, I worked in the travel industry in the early 80s when deregulation happened, and prior to deregulation, we had a lot of really healthy airlines in this country. Since deregulation, we've seen consolidation and disaster. It's a tragedy.
And we don't see any chance of that turning around anytime soon.
Not under this administration. No.
So we're just going to have to deal with that, and I think we're also going to be having to deal with calls next week for the Patriot Act to be made even stronger than it is. Although I don't think that will go down as well.
Instead of saying calls for the Patriot Act to be made stronger, what we should be saying is calls for the Patriot Act to be changed in a way that weakens our civil liberties and protections.
Mm.
Because when we say changes to make the Patriot Act stronger, we're using their language.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah.
So, good point.
Anyhow, as you were saying, pardon my interrupting.
No, absolutely. And so that's basically it. There were more press conferences this morning from the UK, including the Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, who I think is about to become maybe a bit of a darling of the American media. He's very media savvy, very charismatic. It'll be fascinating to see if the American media starts fawning all over him, not realizing that his nickname, as you know, is Red Ken. because you've never been able to get further to the left than Ken Livingstone.
There you go. He's a socialist.
Of the
classic variety.
Classic British socialist, yeah.
Fascinating. Well, if he can pull a Rudy, it'll be interesting to see.
Very.
Victoria Jones, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the report from Washington, D.C. Victoria Jones with us. It is 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Just take what you need. Don't empty out this month.
And welcome back. Oh, it sounds like some sort of commie plot there. Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast. We have with us Scott Vogel, the senior editor at BuzzFlash.com, and David Swanson. What's your title there at AfterDowningStreet.org, David?
Co-founder.
The co-founder at AfterDowningStreet.org. Great to have you, David. Hey, Scott.
How are you, Tom?
Great.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Thank you. Glad to have you both here. First, this is our best of the rest of the news segment where we talk about what else is in the news, what are the things that are being covered, what are the things that are not being covered, what are the things we should be paying attention to, what are the big stories from the past week, and what might be the big stories from the future week. Let me start with you, David. After DowningStreet.org, of course, emerged in part in response to the Downing Street minutes and the Downing Street memos that came out after that, what's happening? What's the status of that story?
Well, we've forced it into the media, but not to the extent that we think it deserves, and so we're pushing harder, and we've forced it into Congress, but again, not to the extent that it deserves. And there is some action. A group of about 50 Congress members filed a Freedom of Information Act request within the past week to the White House and Defense Department and State Department asking for information from this side of the ocean from that same time period, and we'll see where that goes. It didn't go into the media, that's for sure. And we expect there to be a resolution of inquiry introduced in the House within the next couple of weeks. And on the 23rd, which is the three-year anniversary of the Downing Street meeting, there will be town hall meetings with Congress members all over the country and House parties all over the country and rallies at media outlets demanding coverage on that day. And we expect by that point to be able, among other things, to promote a resolution of inquiry. On the other side of the Capitol, within the past week, 10 senators sent a letter to the Intelligence Committee saying, hey, what happened to your investigation? Because they were supposed to investigate this and put it off until after the election and then decided it wasn't worth doing after all. So there's a little bit of action, but it's not in the media the way it ought to be.
Yeah, okay. Scott Vogel. Scott, by the way, we've got an anomaly with the phones here. David's phone is fairly faint, and yours is really hot, Scott. I can hear you breathing on the phone, so you got to be careful about that.
Thank you.
It's just every now and then, you know, we get, it's just the phone lines. It's the nature of the phones. Anyhow, Scott, what's happening with BuzzFlash? What are the hottest stories that you see over there on BuzzFlash.com right now?
Well, right now, obviously, the thing that happens after the bombing in London is you're going to see, I think, a lot of shifting back to the war on terrorism. You can see how Fox News is playing it. You know, someone already blaming our allies for not doing enough on the war on terrorism. What I think is interesting, and the thing that we shouldn't lose sight of, besides the Downing Street memos, which is of the utmost importance, is also the ongoing investigation by U.S. Attorney Peter Fitzgerald. The Washington Post reported that he wants more answers from Karl Rove and his role in possibly being the source. We know, for example, that Matt Cooper from Time magazine was released by whoever that source was to avoid jail time and to their lawyers spoke. We know that Karl Rove's lawyers as well as Matt Cooper's lawyers spoke together. He's been interviewed by Peter Fitzgerald. So that's the story that I
Patrick
think we
Fitzgerald,
should,
isn't it?
Excuse me, Patrick Fitzgerald. That we, we want to keep our eyes on that story and not let it get brushed aside after next week's expected renewed calls on the war on terrorism and the White House trying to use this as an opportunity to shift focus away from the Downing Street memos as well as this investigation into the senior political advisor to the president.
Right. Okay. And David Swanson, I know that for many years you've been very active in promoting the interests of and publicizing the concerns of organized labor as well as a number of other issues. Do you see any labor news on the horizon right at this moment?
Well, certainly on the horizon, there's the 50th anniversary convention of the AFL-CIO, and as well as that of my former employer, the ILCA, the International Labor Communications Association, which is the labor media outlets, magazines, and newsletters. And both of those events are at the end of this month in Chicago, and both will be hotly contested. We know that there is still the possibility that major unions in the Federation will pull out, and we'll see what sort of a labor movement we've got left. And there will be various resolutions on the floor of the AFL convention that are of interest to me and of interest to progressive activists. One is a resolution to oppose the war. And believe it or not, the AFL-CIO has yet to oppose the war. and
wasn't it like 30-35% of their members voted for Bush?
That's correct.
Yeah, it's about a third of them. So, I mean, that may be a position that's a really hot position. I mean, it's the job of the AFL-CIO is not to take, I would think, the job of labor union, for that matter, is not to take a position on foreign policy issues, but to take a position on labor issues and economic issues. Or am I missing something?
Well, then they need to really not take positions on foreign policy issues, but they do. Our labor movement has a history, and it reaches up into the present of really supporting right-wing regimes and working with the Central Intelligence Agency to do so, and that needs to stop.
Labor movement has a history of that?
Absolutely.
How so?
How so? The Solidarity Center, which is a branch of the AFL-CIO, has been heavily involved over the years in directing money to right-wing regimes and playing a part in fighting the Cold War for the United States and working closely with the CIA to do so. And
why would they do that, David?
it doesn't make sense to me. Yeah. You know, it's not a way to help working people, but the thinking presumably in general has been that you're helping American jobs and American industry, and you're not facing the threat of McCarthyist attacks on labor when you've got enough attacks of the plain old.
So this might be an echo. This might be a leftover from back in the days when Ronald Reagan was turning in union members to Joe McCarthy, secretly snitching for the FBI and McCarthy's committee when he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild. That kind of thing. The just, you know, fear and loathing that struck the labor movement in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s about their being aligned with those nasty communists.
Yeah, you know, Newt Gingrich says 1955 was the peak of American society, but, you know, it was also the peak of labor membership. A third of workers were in unions, not one in seven like now. And it was, you know, it was a time of much more progressive taxation and policies and smaller military. But you know, that's when the decline of labor started, and labor has not been a leader in taking progressive positions. And to some extent, it certainly a large federation has to follow its members, but it also has to give its members an opportunity to have a voice. And labor publications and materials need to communicate what's going on. And so we have a grassroots movement within labor, U.S. Labor Against the War, that's passed resolutions against the war in most of the major unions and state federations, but you have the National Federation yet to take a position one way or the other, or even to mention that the war exists in its publications.
Yeah. Interesting. Scott Vogel, thank you, David Swanson of AfterDowningStreet.org. Scott Vogel, senior editor at BuzzFlash.com. Scott, what are the economic issues that you see rolling around in the news right now?
Economically, I think you're going to see a renewed focus. Well, let me tell you what I'm first saying, what I think should be talked about and then what is talked about. What should be talked about is, with what happened in London, is the serious vulnerability the United States has, economically speaking, with respect to the war on terrorism, with the deficit being that
it is. Let's make that the so-called war on terrorism.
I always put it in quotes in my own mind, but when you're on the radio, it doesn't always play. You know, I haven't looked at the exact numbers of how this is going to affect, Europe or England specifically, but what's become very clear, and Richard Clark has talked at length about this in his piece in the Atlantic Monthly many months ago, and that is, besides the risk to the individual, the first responders, the families and victims of a terrorist attack, the real vulnerability, economically speaking, with respect to any terrorist attack in the United States on the homeland, is the threat to our economy. So what should happen is a renewed focus on dealing with the immense structural inequalities that the United States has with respect to the budget, with respect to the ongoing cost of the Iraq war. Economically, obviously, the CAFTA vote is playing up as more of a political story. You know, does the president have the votes? Does he not? The Center for American Progress reported, for example, that they don't believe the president does have the votes in Congress so far. It's at least a tight vote on whether that will pass or not. So you know, frankly, I was just on a radio station, radio interview last week, and frankly, you know, let's talk about what's not being discussed. The fact is, there's been no focus because of the events of the terrorist attack, the Supreme Court debate, the lingering and ongoing problems economically. You know, there's no stories about the squeeze of the middle class, the fact that there's no debate right now going on about the continuing outsourcing of jobs. There was some obviously discussion about China's bid to take over Unocal, but again, our news continues to be about what corporate takeover is happening or what the stock market is doing, and that lacks any substance based on what real Americans are feeling in this economy.
Yeah. Now, also, we have a Supreme Court candidate who is going to be put forward, a nominee who will be put forward by the administration, presumably in the next few weeks or
Correct.
Months, and possibly as many as two more resignations coming up. The word is out that Rehnquist was going to resign today. Apparently he hasn't,
Correct.
But that's coming, and John Paul Stevens is talking about resigning. He's 85 years old. And I wrote an op-ed piece that's been picked up. In fact, I think BuzzFlash picked it up about Gonzalez being the fascist candidate to the extent that some of the candidates are viewed as anti-abortion or pro-business. Gonzalez is the pro-fascism candidate. He's acceptable to business. He used to be one of Enron's lawyers. But do you see that getting any kind of traction, that take on Gonzalez in the mainstream media, or are they completely ignoring his culpability in the destruction of civil rights in the United States?
That will be a very interesting argument. And obviously what the debate will be is, well, haven't we gone through all this when we debated his nomination as Attorney General? So what I think should happen is, I don't think that the case is closed. I think that progressives and American patriots ought to stand up and demand higher standards for a member of the Supreme Court, especially if he's nominated as Chief Justice, as the author and of various memos to the administration advising them on how to navigate and dismiss international law with respect to torture and human rights. I absolutely believe that progressives should challenge that nomination, challenge his record. That what's interesting about Gonzalez is, of course, is that it actually may be more problematic from the right wing than any noise that progressives might make. His decisions as a Texas Supreme Court justice on parental notification with respect to abortion may cause more of an uproar on the conservative and right wing side than any noise that progressives or liberals or Democrats can make based on his role as White House counsel.
Because in parental notification laws in Texas, he took the position that he struck them down? I'm not familiar with the specifics.
I mean, the exact cases, I mean, it's been a while. In one respect, I think he ruled that the law was too broad and didn't account for the safety of the child. And in fact, as a side note, Gonzalez wrote a blistering critique of Priscilla Owens,
sure.
his colleague, because of her, what he called blatant activism on some of those cases. So his positions aren't clear. I think at one point during the confirmation hearings as an attorney general, he, for example, said he supported banning cop killer assault weapons. So, you know, we'll see whether his nomination will offend some of the core bases of the right wing and of the conservative party. Now, one thing to note is right now with the O'Connor resignation, as well as we're expecting the Rehnquist's resignation on Monday. What's going to be difficult, I think, is how the White House is going to manage this. I think they probably would have preferred to handle one at a time.
Don't you think that this actually makes it much easier for them? Because if Bush wants to get Gonzalez in as payback to a friend, and now he can toss in a right-wing crank candidate as, tossing a bone to the dog of the religious right wing, he satisfies everybody.
It depends on how it plays out, but I think after what you saw, the Gang of 14, as it were, who avoided the nuclear option and the shutdown in the Senate, I think you might see a push to grant Bush perhaps a very conservative nominee, which there's no doubt he's going to put up, but also demand some kind of a moderate on the issue of choice or something else.
Yeah.
So it depends.
And I think that moderate is going to be Gonzalez. They're going to call him again. They're going to repackage him as a moderate.
You know what? I think you're absolutely right, Tom. I think they are going to package Gonzalez as a moderate, and hopefully that won't stick, but yeah. This is the corporate media we're talking about.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds left. David Swanson with AfterDowningStreet.org, what do you see as the biggest story coming down the road next week?
I don't know. I think that it's either Supreme Court or terrorism, with, you know, the events in London of this week being misused as.
You think they're going to echo on down through? What, Scott Vogel, senior editor of BuzzFlash.com, what's your take on that?
My guess is this. I'm curious what the White House is going to roll out after what happened in London. I think you're going to see a week or two of capitalizing on that tragedy, scaring Americans to death yet again, trying to have it both ways, saying, oh, we need to be vigilant and still say that we're protecting Americans from terrorism.
There you go. Okay. Scott Vogel, senior editor of BuzzFlash.com. David Swanson, co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Much appreciated. Keep up the great work. It's so important to have an independent press, and our web press is so much of our independent press these days. Support these folks. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The fact is that they tell you lies. Remain like oil becomes democracy.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Now, the Delay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom Delay. How long can he hang on? The old guy hanging on by his fingernails there. This from Wayne Slater. A company indicted in a Texas campaign fundraising case says it was told that by giving a Tom Delay political committee $25,000, company officials would get access to the U.S. House Majority Leader to influence legislation. This, of course, is a crime. In court documents, Westar Energy of Kansas says that to meet with Mr. Delay in 2002, company officials, quote, were told they needed to write a check for $25,000, end quote, to Texans for a Republican majority known as the Trim Pack. It's the first time a company has said it donated to the Texas committee created by Mr. Delay in exchange for a meeting and legislative help. An aide to Mr. Delay denied that he was swayed by the donation. Spokeswoman Shannon Flaherty said, quote, anyone who has worked with Majority Leader Delay knows that his legislative efforts are based on sound policy alone. Well, and maybe how much bug killer you can give him to inhale. This is good stuff, yes. Good old Tom Delay. As a result of the contribution, two Westar executives attended a June 2002 golf outing with Mr. Delay and two top aides at the Homestead Resort in Hot Springs, Virginia. Isn't it time that we start asking ourselves, is this the kind of government? Do we really want to have the best government money can buy, to paraphrase Greg Palast's book title? The provision sought by Westar was included in a House bill with Mr. Delay's support, but was ultimately withdrawn after a grand jury in Austin began investigating corporate fundraising in 2002 in the Texas legislative races. A Travis County grand jury has indicted three Delay associates and eight companies, including Westar, on charges of violating Texas laws that forbid the use of corporate money to elect political candidates. Prosecutors, however, dropped felony indictments against four of the corporations in exchange for an agreement on the part of the corporations to pay for programs examining the use of corporate money in politics. Imagine this. Somebody goes in to rob a 7-Eleven. They get caught, and the cops say, hey, listen, we won't prosecute you if you'll donate $50 to a study to study why people go into 7-Elevens and stick them up. I can see it. A dramatic transformation coming in our criminal justice system. Leading the way, the state of Texas. You get caught in a crime, and if you don't want to be prosecuted, all you have to do is give some money to some group that's going to study why you committed that crime. Talk about soft on crime. This is the Delay Republicans. George Bush's Texas. Oh, my goodness. Well, what can we do about it? What you can do is start getting involved in politics. I sound like a broken record. I'm telling you, get out there, get active. Go to democracyforamerica.com and sign up. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartmann here with you. Yes, indeed. Iran and Iraq getting together. A startling article on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal about illegal immigrants and banks I want to share with you. The folks in the chat room wondering what's up with Tom DeLay. Has he sniffed too much bug killer? I'm going to drop into our chat room. Go to TomHartmann.com and get you in there. Just click live chat, and it'll just pop open the window for you. And our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, if you'd like to call 1-866-889-8894. Scott in San Diego, in fact, on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. It's being on my mind today is being active. It's not just getting active, and I found a few things that I can do, and I wanted to tell you this the past few times I've called. What I can do, I'm disabled, so I can't walk precincts as I'd like. I can cover a few blocks, but what I can do is get on the phone, and I do that for Donna Frye, the mayoral candidate here. Our election's coming up quickly. I do that for different issues that are in my neighborhood right here in our immediate few blocks, and that's the way I stay active. I can't email so much. I'm disabled. I only have the use of my right hand, so I can't type like I used to. But I found what I can do is get on the phone and call people. So I'm calling today in your program asking for all y'all out there listening and all y'all in the chat room, if you can, get on the phone and support a local candidate. It's easy to do. And, Tom, I'd be happy to help anyone with professional phone training that wanted to call and find out a few tips about being on the phone and calling their neighbors and calling their friends.
Well, that's a great one, Scott. Two questions. First of all, how do you decide or how do you find a local candidate to support?
Well, Donna Frye, because I pay attention to local politics here at the council, the San Diego City Council, I've been following what she's been doing for a while. And when she announced her candidacy last time, of course, I immediately voted for her. But this time I thought I could really get involved with her candidacy. Francine Busby I'm supporting because Duke Cunningham's antics in Congress disgust me.
Yeah.
And I'm getting on the phone for her and helping her raise money.
So the way that you determined who to support is you've been reading the paper, you've been tracking the news. When you see local candidates, just absolutely local candidates, who may be aspiring to higher office or who are doing well, then you contact them.
Exactly. I call them up on the phone and I volunteer.
Okay, great. Now, if somebody wanted to volunteer, in fact, I have a friend in Pennsylvania who I know has been very active in the political campaign of a candidate for the Senate from Pennsylvania, and I know that he went through a bit of a training program. How do you, you know, what do you say to people? How would you train somebody if they were saying, you know, I'd like to be able to make phone calls, I'd like to contact people. What do you do? Give me, you know, the 30-second course here.
Sure. The first thing is to have some kind of a script in front of you when you make the call so you know what you're going to say. You've got a list in front of you of the names you're going to call. Put a mirror in front of you so you can see that you're smiling. It's very important to smile on the phone. People can actually hear a smile, believe it or not.
That's true.
And a slow, steady voice really works well. So I have a script in front of me of what I'm going to say. And normally that's provided. They have a few scripts for you, a few things you can put together on your own.
Do you want, Scott, the script to be talking points or do you want it to be every single word?
I memorize the script before I call. They're normally very short, no more than 30 seconds or a minute. And I typically, after a few calls, I'll get a few talking points because it tends to work out that people ask about the same question almost every time.
Yeah, but it seems like it would be more conversational if you were simply talking from talking points. I've had people call me and, you know, do sales pitches on the phone. Hello, I am calling to see if you'd like to participate in a survey on vacuum cleaning. And you know right off that they're reading something. And that
exactly.
Puts a lot of people off, I think.
It really does. And again, they're running from a script as well, and usually they're pretty new at doing this. And that's why I normally memorize what they've given me, which is a very short I'm calling you good afternoon or good morning. I'm calling. My name is Scott Olson. I'm calling you today on behalf of Donna Frye. I'm asking you if you would like, if you can get out and vote. Our vote is coming up. Are you aware of Donna Frye? That kind of thing. I'll have all that written down before I start. And that's what I stick with. And frankly, I'm not saying a whole lot. I'm getting them to say a few things and giving me some kind of a commitment. Yes, I'll be happy to get out, or yes, I love Donna Frye, we'll be voting, that kind of thing.
Okay, good. Good on you, Scott. Congratulations, keep up the good work, and thank you for just educating our listeners.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's called being active, and I like being active because I can make a difference, and I do.
There you go. Better than getting active. It implies somebody's sedentary to begin with. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Javier and Arciela Garcia, illegal immigrants from Mexico, writes Miriam Jordan in the Wall Street Journal today, never imagined that the U.S. government would help them realize their dream of owning a home. A home in the United States. Illegal immigrants. Keep in mind how long people have to wait to become legal immigrants. It can be years. Years. But last year, the couple secured a $54,600 mortgage to buy the gray 1,158 square foot bungalow that they had been renting for 8 months. The Wisconsin Housing Authority financed the plan. The Internal Revenue Service gave them an ID number that enabled them to apply for it at the local Mitchell Bank, which was happy to take their business. Mrs. Garcia said, "We thought we would never buy a home because of our illegal status." The article goes on to talk about how this bank in this Wisconsin community noticed that the bank wasn't doing all that well. Between 1990 and 2000, their business was falling off. And at the same time, the community was becoming more heavily Hispanic. They say for most of its history, the bank served Polish and German immigrants. As European families moved to the suburbs, Mitchell Bank opened new branches there, but bank loyalty didn't transfer to young customers who preferred big banks with ATMs on every corner. In the 90s, they began to see, on the south side, an influx of Latino immigrants, taco shops and whatnot. And they tell a story about how one of the bank's senior officers, Mr. Maloney, 1999, he's driving down the street, and he sees, you know, he's got a big empty bank, and outside the street is full of Latinos. And he says, if all these people were working here and living here, I knew we had to change what we do. He took over the bank after his father-in-law died in 1991. So he promoted Frank Villa, a teller and the sole Hispanic employee, to customer service representative, rehired a former Latina staffer, recruited others, put up a picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe, Mexico's patron saint, in the bank, translated the bank's brochures and deposit slips into Spanish, hung banners in Spanish outside. Hey, come here, do your banking. Invited community leaders and clergy to the town-style meeting at the bank. And began serving the illegal immigrant community. The problem that they were having initially when they started doing this early on in the Bush administration, in the early years of the George W. Bush administration, was that they were concerned their mortgages, the mortgages that they were issuing to these illegal immigrant families, were not backed up by federal loan guarantees, and so if the families defaulted, the bank might be stuck. This could be a problem for them. So in 2002, they made a presentation to the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, and they worked something out. The IRS is issuing a taxpayer registration number. It's called the Individual Taxpayer Identification Number, or ITIN, instead of a Social Security number, which illegal immigrants cannot generally obtain. The banks have to have some number. When they have to list, here's the amount of money that we made on this mortgage, and this is the person that we got it from. That person has to have a number associated with their name. Typically, if it's a legal citizen of the United States, the number is a Social Security number. If it's a corporation, it's called the Employer Identification Number, the EIN. Well, for an illegal immigrant, the Bush administration has decided it should be an ITIN, Individual Taxpayer Identification Number, a number for a person who is paying taxes but is here illegally. As of December 2004, 8 million such numbers have been issued by the Internal Revenue Service. In the last 4 years, Mitchell Bank has issued 100 similar home loans, mainly to illegal immigrants. They've never experienced a default and only two late payments. So much like, you know, historic migrant communities, by and large, these are folks who are plugging into the community and doing well and trying to acquire the American dream. The only problem is they're here illegally. And I would say, you know, frankly, for me, that's a big problem. Now, the take on this that a lot of folks are going to take is the, you know, there are racist xenophobes out there who are going to, oh, no, you know, the brown people are coming. There's going to be that take. And then there's going to be the folks who are, you know, just jingoistic. They don't have a specific take other than, oh, it's bad. I got to tell you, my take is going to be quite different than any of these. And that is that in the 30 years ago, in the 1980s, in the United States, the 1970s in the United States, we didn't have this problem. We didn't have 10% of Mexico's population in the United States illegally, sending home checks to Mexico, producing 10% of Mexico's gross domestic product, of Mexico's economy, and therefore we didn't have the president of Mexico, like we have now, former Coca-Cola executive Vicente Fox, printing brochures in Spanish telling Mexicans how to illegally enter the United States and not die in the desert when they try and make the crossing. Yes, the Mexican government is publishing such brochures. And the reason we didn't have that problem is because we had a strong middle class in America that had good paying jobs. And everybody knew that, you know, hey, if you got a job, it's a good job. And the cheap labor jobs represented a small part of the marketplace. And there was a small part of the marketplace that was looking for cheap labor jobs, mostly high school students, you know, high school dropouts, but mostly high school students or kids working their way through college. I mentioned earlier, I worked in a Domino's when I was in high school. And I worked in a gas station when I was in high school. These are the jobs that people would get, and it's just a temporary job. It was a part-time job. And so what has happened is after 30 years of Reaganomics destroying the good-paying middle-class jobs, there is such a large market of low-paying jobs now that there's room for the illegal immigrants to come in and say, we'll do that. And had we not changed the fundamental nature of the labor landscape in the United States, we wouldn't have all these immigrants. I mean, it's not like all of a sudden we stopped enforcing the borders. In fact, our border enforcement now is dramatically greater than it was 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago, when we weren't being inundated by illegals. What has happened is the nature and makeup of our labor marketplace. And that's the direct result of anti-labor, anti-middle class, so-called conservative Republican policies. Our trade policies, our taxation policies, primarily our trade policies, and our policies with regard to labor and the enforcement of labor laws. And it's got to change. Otherwise, we're just going to see a continual disintegration of the middle class in the United States. And, you know, it's very profitable for corporations. George Bush loves it. Half of the illegal immigrants caught coming across the border said they were coming because they had heard Bush was going to be offering an amnesty. Go figure. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance.
But you gotta serve somebody.
You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve somebody.
And George W. has in mind that you be serving him. It's the corporate takeover of America. Absolutely scary. More banks are following in Mitchell Bank's path. Mitchell Bank is the bank that is giving home loans and refinancing and checking accounts and whatever they want full banking services to illegal immigrants. More banks are following Mitchell's path, writes Miriam Jordan in today's Wall Street Journal. Helped by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which has reached out to banks in the Midwest to encourage them to lend to immigrants regardless of their legal status in this country. Some of the banks have become aggressive players in the undocumented market. This is a marketplace. Now, this has been defined as a marketplace. Illegal immigrants. Now, you know, as I said, I am all in favor of immigration to the United States. I am my grandfather and grandmother on my father's side of the family were immigrants to the United States. They came over here from Norway just before World War I. And my grandfather then joined the American Army. I mean, he was a disabled American, a member of the DAV, Disabled American Veterans, from World War I. I remember marching in the parades with him, 4th of July and Veterans Day, as a little kid. So, you know, I'm not anti-immigrant. I'm the product of an immigrant. But illegal immigration, in my opinion, harms a country because it does not allow a country to have any kind of an industrial policy, any kind of labor policy, any kind of domestic policies that can be followed through on appropriately, unless immigration is the policy. And it was during the first, say, 150 years, more or less, of this country's history. We threw the doors open and said, anybody who needs to come on over, you know, come on over. We've got plenty of land here. It wasn't a popular strategy with the Native Americans, but that's what we did. And, you know, I'm not justifying it or anything, but it's just that's the history. But that hasn't been our status for 100 years, more or less. We've been saying, now, wait a minute. If you want to come to the United States, there are certain requirements. And particularly in this age of our engaging in international activities that are causing people in other countries to want to harm us. George Bush kicking beehives all over the world. You know, there's bees out there. This is not the time to be saying, oh, illegal immigrants? Fine, we'll give them a mortgage. I just don't get it. It seems to me like the wrong thing to do. But the problem is that if we only try to deal with it at the level of the immigrants themselves, and say, oh, it's the immigrants' problem, and we just, you know, we need to put up a 200-foot-tall wall on the Mexican border, it's not going to solve the problem. Because the problem isn't the immigrants. It's not the people who are here who are the problem. It's the conditions that caused them to come here, both in the United States and Mexico. You know, we have the failures of the Central and South American governments. And I could rant about that at some length. I've spent a lot of time down there. And you have the failure of the United States, the government of the United States now, to make sure that our labor market is such that there's not a lot of demand for for illegal immigrant labor. It's not just from Mexico. It's from all over Central America and South America even, but primarily from Mexico, for folks to be coming into this country. Because if we decide that we're going to have an economy where the average job is such a low-paying job that an illegal immigrant would do it, then we don't have an economy anymore. We don't have a middle class anymore. And if we don't have a middle class anymore, we don't have a democracy anymore. I mean, that's where it's going to go. And, of course, that's the agenda of the so-called conservatives, is rip apart the idea of representative democracy and replace it with corporate aristocracy. Have a small ruling elite, the conservative elite, the corporate conservative elite, and a large, frightened worker bee class. Always on the edge of debt and disaster. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, tomhartman.com, the website. How many of our civil liberties do we have to give up in order to succeed in the so-called war on terror? It looks like some folks have different ideas about this than others. State Senator Joe Dunn of California is with us, a Democrat from Garden Grove, California. Senator, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here, and I want to first of all salute you, sir, for being willing to run for office in these difficult times and holding up the torch of liberty. It's a good thing.
I appreciate that, Tom.
You announced today that your office has obtained information that evidence about an investigation that you're conducting into domestic spying by the California National Guard may have been destroyed. Domestic spying by the California National Guard?
Yes, indeed, Tom. What this all about is there was a media report about a week and a half ago of a anti-war protest that occurred on Mother's Day at the state capitol, a very small one, and an email from the governor's office to the National Guard asked that their special surveillance unit keep an eye on this rally. Well,
let me interrupt you right there.
Sure.
Isn't that against the law?
It is. There is a federal law called the Posse Comitatus Act, which was passed in the late 1800s, that in effect says the use of military officials domestically is not allowed under the law except under isolated circumstances, which, of course, those circumstances don't apply.
Well, the circumstances that the Posse Comitatus law talks about is rebellion, as I recall.
That is correct, Tom. Good memory. And it's been in law for many, many years.
Since the 1880s.
Fact, yeah. That's correct. That's when it was passed. After 9/11, the Patriot Act, which of course has many problems with it, even in the Patriot Act, they reconfirm the Posse Comitatus Act with respect to United States military officials. So the problem we have here is how does the Posse Comitatus Act apply to a non-activated guard unit, whether in California or anywhere else?
Now, what does activated mean?
The United States president can call up to active duty National Guard units. When they are not called up by the federal authorities to active status, they fall under state law. And the reason this is important is there is no state version of the Posse Comitatus Act. The federal one would only apply if they had been called up by the President of the United States. What may have happened here, and we don't have solid evidence on it, but I'm getting uneasy feeling, is that sometime after 9/11, as a means of circumventing the federal Posse Comitatus Act, the Bush administration may very well have asked non-activated state guard units to engage in domestic spying, knowing that activated or regular military personnel cannot engage in that activity under the federal Posse Comitatus Act. The unit in question here in California was created almost 2 years ago. We have no idea what its activities have been for the past 2 years, other than the Mother's Day, to monitor the Mother's Day rally. And we have now asked for all the documents about the creation of the unit, the activities of the unit, and we are in a struggle with the National Guard at this point in time to get access to those documents.
So this could be not just a small aberration with one National Guard unit in the state of California. This could be a systemic nationwide program where the White House is getting the National Guard to play domestic spy agency because they can't legally get anybody else to do it.
Tom, you are absolutely correct. And once our investigation receives some media coverage, we've been receiving calls from other guard units in other states indicating that a similar surveillance unit was created in their guard at approximately the same time. We're trying to chase that down and confirm that information in a variety of different states and trying to confirm where the initial orders came to create these secret surveillance units within the guard units that are not on federal activated status.
We're talking with State Senator Joe Dunn of California. Senator Dunn, it seems, you know, I've had friends over the years who are in the National Guard. In fact, a good friend of mine right now is in the National Guard and is in Iraq. And most of them were people who, this guy was actually the headmaster of a school. You know, they're people who just have jobs, you know, normal jobs, and they join the Guard to get a little extra money and because they enjoy playing weekend warrior, and with the idea that if there's a hurricane or a natural disaster or a forest fire, you know, hey, they'll jump in to help. It's their community after all, which is what the National Guard usually does. And in the unlikely event that the nation was invaded by Mexico or Canada, that, you know, they would be there to fight back, right? And it just seems to me that there are enough kind of average Joes in the National Guard in particular, that this isn't the sort of secret that could be kept. What am I missing here?
You are correct about that. It's not an organization designed for the highly sophisticated work that is done in other law enforcement agencies or done overseas by our U.S. military forces. That's absolutely correct. And their training is limited to helping out on the natural disasters or some limited training in the unlikely event they get called to active duty and sent overseas. Which is why we are curious how there was a veil of secrecy maintained over this unit for almost 2 years, and that its discovery was really quite accidental when one news outlet got a copy of the email from the governor's office to this unit about the Mother's Day protest. Now, it's taken a sinister turn here recently, Tom, as you're probably aware, in that after we requested the documents relating to this unit and its activities early last week, we've been informed, and there's been media coverage, of the fact that the Guard has destroyed documents, including a hard drive that belonged to the guy who commanded the unit, who resigned suddenly last week and has left the state.
That would be Colonel Robert J. O'Neill.
No, it is Colonel Davis, O'Neill reported to Davis prior to his sudden retirement last week and departure from the state.
Oh, okay.
We have already advised the Guard that we intend to take sworn depositions of all the folks involved, whether they're still in the state or still outside the state, and we know that they are retaining their own legal counsel right now, and we may end up in a large legal battle over the legislature's ability to access this information, since if for no other reason we control their budget and they never disclose the creation of this unit or the dedication of personnel to the secret surveillance unit.
And in fact, you're the chairman of the state budget subcommittee that has budgetary oversight over the California National Guard, are you not?
That is correct, Tom, and I've dealt with all the commanders that are constantly being quoted in the press almost on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis through various budget cycles, and even at a personal level, I am dismayed to say the least that they never disclose the creation of this unit or the dedication of personnel to it.
Yeah, this is quite remarkable. I back in the 60s, the late 60s, early 70s, I was involved in the anti-war movement in back in Michigan, and I remember when it came out a decade later that the state police in that state had generated this Red Guard unit, Red Squad, I think it was called, and they were, you know, secretly spying on us and all this kind of thing. People were going down and getting their records. That was a bit disillusioning, I think, for a lot of folks. This seems like it goes a whole level beyond that. If this is a national thing, and if it's what sort of sinister activity was going on at the Mother's Day parade or protest that would justify Governor Schwarzenegger asking the National Guard to send spies down there? Was there a threat of terrorist activity? Were people going to show up with guns? Who were the sinister actors here?
Well, let me answer the first question first, Tom, and that is there was absolutely positively nothing about that rally that would have justified any surveillance. It was by three groups. One of them was a group of widows of soldiers who were killed in Iraq. The other one was the Raging Grannies from the Bay Area, been around since the 1960s, just grandmothers protesting against the war, and then Code Pink. Those three organizations were the ones that organized it. There were only a handful of people there.
Code Pink has given George Bush hell. I mean, they're the group that, for example, at his inauguration, dropped a banner and, you know, got hauled off and arrested. They've been. I'm not saying that they're terrorists or anything
right.
at all like that, but I mean they're a high profile activist group, and
yeah.
The Raging Grannies are fairly well known.
Yes.
And so if you wanted to damage groups that are being successful in getting media coverage and successful in challenging, you know, in saying the emperor has no clothes, in challenging the authority or misappropriated authority of an administration, those are the groups that are doing it. So it seems that all the more reason to be concerned, it seems.
It is, and this is unfortunately, sorry to quote Yogi Berra here, but it is deja vu all over again, because as you referenced, Tom, back in 68 and 69, when that the domestic spying was engaged in by military officials here in the United States, it resulted in large congressional hearings chaired by Senator Sam Ervin at the time. He issued a report in 1970 that was scathing about the activities. I sat down and read that earlier this week, and unfortunately, I might as well have been reading about what's been occurring in the California National Guard. It's seemingly an absolute repeat of what occurred in 68 and 69. And we all have short-term memories, but none of us look back on those days thinking that was proper activity by the United States military.
Yeah.
Hey, as we all know, this country was founded, one of its founding principles from the founding fathers was keep an absolute separation between the civilian population and military troops.
Right, that's why the commander-in-chief of the military is the civilian, the top civilian elected officer, the President
absolutely.
Of the United States.
Absolutely
the
correct.
The whole point of it. Yeah, it's, boy, mind-boggling. I recall also when the documentation of this state police group in Michigan came out, and they were, you know, people would go down and get their files, and in some cases, a friend of mine, his file was, I mean, it filled a box, you know, it was huge. It was like a foot and a half long of documents. And one of the things that we found was that there was this one guy who always showed up at all the anti-war rallies, and he was always yelling for, you know, kill the pigs, and, you know, and trying to get people to, like, throw things and you know, who's got Molotov cocktail? You know, I mean, nobody did, but, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, he was the guy that we all figured was going to be the first one arrested if there was ever a problem, because he was the one who was so outspoken, so loud, so constantly trying to get people to engage in acts of violence. And it turns out that he was, I don't recall if he was with the FBI or with the police, but he was an official. He was a spy among us, and which moves from spying into provocation. Are you seeing any evidence that that cycle is being repeated? I mean, Frank Church talked about that in those committee hearings.
We have not seen any evidence of that whatsoever. Now, the National Guard is supposed to turn over their documentation to us by 4 o'clock today. They have made public pronouncements that they intend to comply with the 4 o'clock deadline. We have numerous sources inside the National Guard that are telling us a completely different story, that critical documents that we need to review are going to be withheld, that, as we know, computer files have already been erased. And although I wish that this was simply a misunderstanding between the legislature and the Guard and its activities, every indication we've had since we first sent a letter to them over a week and a half ago is indicating that this is going to be a struggle for some time to come till we get to the truth of why this unit was created and what activities it's been up to for the past almost 2 years, particularly with respect to spying on United States citizens.
Senator Joe Dunn, what evidence do you have or what information do you have that this unit was set up at the behest of the White House and that these operations may be happening in other states as well as California?
We don't have any evidence that it was set up at the behest of the White House. However, we've gotten indications from sources in other states, unconfirmed thus far, that there are similar units in other states. If that is true, I can't help but conclude that this was a orchestrated effort that seemingly would immediately point to Washington, D.C. and to this administration, all under the name of fighting terrorism. Now, we all realize that terrorism today is an entirely different warfare than what we've been traditionally used to in the history of the United States. We all get that, and we have to adjust to it. However, terrorism does not justify the suspension of the constitutional rights of United States citizens. That is a given, and if, in fact, this is an orchestrated plan nationwide to spy on United States citizens without the legal authority, we have ourselves what I believe to be a national scandal on our hands.
Well, and in fact, we actually have, I mean, let's just be candid about this. We have a long history of problems with terrorism in the United States. For a long time, the major terrorist organization in the United States, perhaps in the world, was the Ku Klux Klan. And they, you know, they regularly involve themselves in terrorist incidents. The second largest terrorist incident happened in the United States. The bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City was done by a white Christian, you know, Tim McVeigh, who was involved with white separatist groups. And those groups are still around. I mean, this guy down in Texas was busted just last year with enough with a cyanide gas bomb that could have killed everybody inside a 30,000 square foot building, and he intended to use it from all indications. We just don't talk about it that much. But, you know, terrorism is a part of our history, and it doesn't seem that the kind of good police work that would be necessary to fight terrorism is any different today than it was 50 years ago in terms of, you know, if you just do that work. We shouldn't have to give up our civil liberties and alter our fundamental concepts of the separation between military and civilian oversight in order to succeed.
You're absolutely correct, Tom. And there's something even more, not I can't say more fundamental. You've tapped on the most fundamental principle. But there is a vast difference in the training between military officials and domestic law enforcement officials. Domestic law enforcement officials are trained that deadly force is a last resort, that you have to constantly monitor the constitutional rights of the individuals you come in contact with as a law enforcement personnel at a domestic level. That's not the training of military officials. Military, for obvious reasons, are trained to use deadly force right out of the box. Yep. Constitutional rights are not a high priority for them because they're assigned to fight an entirely different type of situation than domestic law enforcement.
Yeah.
So when you use militarily trained individuals on a domestic level, you have a problem on your hands.
Yeah, the military is basically trained to kill people and blow things up.
That's correct.
And that's what they're supposed to do. I mean,
correct.
Such an important point. Senator Joe Dunn, Democrat of Garden Grove, California State Senator, thanks so much for the good work you're doing, Senator.
Tom, thank you.
Keep it up and keep us up to date on what's going on. I'd like to follow this story.
I will do that.
Thank you, sir. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Whatever you want, whatever you need, I will be right here waiting.
And welcome back, my friends. Sacramento, AP story. Military authorities yesterday began investigating whether a California National Guard unit was created to spy on citizens, as dozens of demonstrators confronted guard officials while armed soldiers stood by. Boy, shades of Kent State. I mean, it's like it's coming all around again. The federal probe of the nation's largest National Guard force involves the Army's Inspector General, the Federal National Guard Bureau's Inspector General, and the National Guard Bureau's Legal Division. The unit has raised concern among peace activists that the Guard is resorting to the same type of civilian monitoring that helped fuel protests during the Vietnam War. During the 1960s and 70s, the military collected information on more than 100,000 Americans. Such monitoring, while not illegal, would be a departure for the Guard. I think it's illegal. George Main, president of Veterans for Peace, said, "These are your mothers, grandmothers, and neighbors. They are not potential terrorist threats," he said. "The excuse that these groups might be infiltrated is an insult to the intelligence of every Californian." And as we just heard from Senator Joe Dunn, it looks like it goes way beyond that. Under scrutiny, the California National Guard unit with a tongue-twisting name, the Information Synchronization Knowledge Management and Intelligence Fusion Program, came to light in a recent story in the San Jose Mercury News. This began with an email from Governor Schwarzenegger, the Mother's Day anti-war demonstration, saying, "Go check this thing out." Here's my concern. Schwarzenegger, who in the past has spoken highly of Nazis, whose father, of course, was a Nazi, and proud of it, in Austria. Schwarzenegger, the Terminator guy, the we love, you know, macho guy, and Bush, who, while, you know, when he was young and it had to do with actually the possibility of fighting, chickened out and got his father's friends to pull strings for him to get into the Texas Air National Guard. Nonetheless, as an older man now, loves to strut around and be macho and be seen as military. It concerns me that these folks may be having in their sights our civil liberties. The whole idea of control, terrified people, frightened people, tend to be the most dangerous in terms of control. It was the weakness, the moral weakness, the cultural weakness, the political weakness, actually, of the Nazis that made them so dangerous. And now the Bush administration, the Schwarzenegger administration, down in the polls, Republicans sinking in the polls, will they be turning to police, to Gestapo-like tactics in order to retain their power, in order to hold their power? Let us hope not. And let's keep careful track on this. Thanks so much for being with us this week, my friends. We'll be back on Monday. Happy Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom. Do good. Have a great weekend. Enjoy yourself. Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.